Thank you, everybody, for coming. My name is Joanne Hart. I'm on the board of the Gloucester Writers Center, and we're so glad to have you here tonight. And we're so always so happy to be in the Rocky Neck Cultural Center. It's a new space for us in Gloucester, and it's really just stunning. And I feel a little like a minister here.
Yeah.
I guess we'll hear that soon. All right, so we're here tonight to welcome three members of Presence Presenza, North American Writers of Portuguese Descent. I'd like to thank Deo Braga and his wife Paula, who sponsored tonight's event. I'm not sure if they're here, helping to bring these Luso-American voices to Gloucester. Deo moved to the United States from Portugal in 1981 and now owns several businesses here in Gloucester, including the Azorian Restaurant. This was last night. I think some of you just came from there. And which serves wonderful Portuguese cuisine. Gloucester's home to a large population of those of Portuguese descent who came for the fishing industry, as they did in Provincetown and New Bedford. And Massachusetts has the highest percentage of Portuguese or Luso-Americans in the country. A little factoid I found out doing an article for the Pastrana tapestries that were at the PEM. I said there are only two or three places in all the United States. I was like, why here? This is why. Pastrana tapestries are the famous Portuguese medieval tapestries. Before I introduce our writers, I have a few Writer Center announcements. We have a mug-up workshop series going for a six-week session with a different topic every week. They start, you can take one or all sign up for all six. It's cheaper if you register for all six. And the first one starts this Saturday, where Amanda Cook will run a workshop on writing a poem for the Letters to the Editor page, which is a particular Gloucester thing. It used to be, they still do that. Vincent Farini, in the end, was the only poet allowed to write a letter to the editor in verse instead of prose. Then on April 13th, Anne McCardle will run a workshop on writing dialogue. And we have the brochures in the back, or you can go to the website to see the whole schedule of the series. And then there's an evening workshop next week I'd like to bring your attention to, particularly as we have writers here reading. Linda Robinson, a wonderful actor here in town who runs our 10-minute play workshops, is going to do a one-night workshop on helping writers present their own work, standing behind the microphone and reading. Very useful. And then we have a speaker series, and once again, it's all there on that wonderful board, our speakers coming up, including April 6th, that's just this weekend, we're hosting three Lowell poets, Paul Marion, Chuck Levenstein, and Brian Gallagher. And on April 10th, we'll welcome Steve Almond and David Krause in conjunction with Eastern Point Press. On April 27th, there will be a dramatic reading of the plays produced in the Linda Robinson 10-minute play workshop. I did that myself last fall. It was great. And that workshop is already in progress and almost over. On May 1st, we'll host poet Mary Campbell and writer John Engstrom. And there's many more. So please pick up a brochure, and especially about the big Vincent Farini 100th birthday celebration coming up on June 22nd. And that's going to be at Maritime Gloucester. So we want everybody to save the date for that. So thank you, Andy Thomas, Henry Farini, our leaders here, and the rest of the board for making literature alive in Gloucester. So it is my particular pleasure to introduce Una Patrick tonight, who will then introduce our other writers, Sarah Chaves and Brian Souza. Una and I have known each other for over 15 years, maybe even close to 20, when we were both taking a nonfiction class at Harvard Extension. And then we were ended up both at the Bennington MFA program almost simultaneously. And even from the very beginning at Harvard Extension, she wrote these essays about Provincetown that were just touching and beautiful. And I thought, oh my God, this is like the most incredible writer. And I'm so happy that she's here to share with us tonight. We've even been at the Dorset's Writing Colony at the same time. Una is a Provincetown native who lives in Brooklyn, and her ancestors were whalers and fishermen from the Azores. She earned degrees from Brown University and the Bennington Writing Seminars. Her nonfiction has appeared in various journals and has been reprinted in a UMass writing textbook and in a collection published in Portugal. Her writing has received a Pushcart Prize nomination and notable essay citations in Best American Essays and Best American Travel Writing. She's worked on the Disquiet International Literary Program in Lisbon, Portugal, since it began in 2011, and she serves as the Luso American liaison for the program. So I introduce Una.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Good. Thank you all for coming, and thanks to the Gloucester Writers Center for inviting us. Special thanks to Henry Farini, Joanne Hart, Annie Thomas, and Alyssa East for all your help. We're really happy to be part of what you have going on here. As Joanne told you, tonight's reading is part of a larger endeavor. It's one of over a dozen group readings by writers of Portuguese descent that have been happening everywhere from Montreal to San Francisco since this time last year. Our Massachusetts readings alone have unexpectedly turned into a five-city tour. About 15 years ago, I was in the Provincetown Library and came across a book of poems called The Holyoke by Frank Gaspar, a Provincetown native of Portuguese descent. I had the stunning realization that this was the first time I had ever read anything about the people I grew up with, written from their own perspective. I was just getting started in writing, and that experience changed the direction of my life. The summer before last, I relived that experience on a larger scale. At the first Disquiet program in Lisbon, Frank Gaspar taught a workshop called Writing the Luso-American Experience for the 16 writers of Luso descent who were part of the program. As they introduced themselves that first day, nearly every person in the room shared a memory about beginning to write and thinking that they were the only Luso-American writer out there, or at least the only writer in their community. Most had never met another writer of Portuguese descent before. There was a sense of isolation coming to an end. We founded our collective, Presence Presença, as a way to combat that isolation and address what we felt was the relative absence of Luso-American voices in the American literary scene. Since that day, we've recruited more than 150 writers online, and we make a point of including those with roots in all parts of the Lusophone world, including Brazilians, Cape Verdeans, Goans, and more. Our next stop is the Mass Poetry Fest in Salem on May 4th, where we'll be reading poems about the Pastrana tapestries. Besides the readings, members have been doing outreach as visiting writers at a school for underprivileged girls in New Bedford all this year, and the students will be holding their own reading in New Bedford this month. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can pick up a card in the back or just talk to me. I'm going to read first, and then I'll introduce our other two readers tonight. I'll be reading a nonfiction piece related to my memoir of the Portuguese community in Provincetown. It's in the form of a timeline, and I'll be skipping over about half of it for the sake of time. Many of the entries are not me speaking, but they're quotes from old books. Timeline, a memoir. 10,000 BC, the Cape Cod Bay ice lobe declines to form Provincetown. The rest of Cape Cod is an outwashed plain, but Provincetown is just detritus, a relatively temporary sand formation. 1705, fishing and smuggling are key industries in the province lands. Outlandish men, I judge Portuguese, are spotted at work. The legend of Helltown, a settlement of pirates, criminals, and outcasts at the end of the Cape, begins to take root. 1700s, the Lord's Prayer is translated into the Wampanoag Indian language. Father ours, above in heaven, admired in highest manner, by thy name, like done, thy will, on earth as like in heaven. Let us be forgiven evil doings of ours, as we would forgive wrongdoers to us. October 25th, 1714, At the easterly end of a cliff near the Cape Harbor, called by the Indians Kekquonicut and by the English Cormorant Hill, at a jawbone of a whale set in the ground there by the side of a red oak stump, Provincetown officially begins. 1801, the first Provincetown smallpox epidemic, only one of many for the Indians of Cape Cod. Not guide us into snares, but help us to escape from evil. 1808, my great-great-great-great-grandmother on my father's side, Rebecca Smith of Wellfleet, marries James Birch of England in Provincetown, and they settle in town. 1818, Rebecca Crook, the last Harwich Sakwatucket Indian, dies. Thine, thy powerful kingdom, thine the strength, thine the greatest glory. Always, always wish me so. Amen. 1860s to 1900, Portuguese from the Azores settle in tight. They anglicize their names, but they bring one word they refuse to translate. Saudade, a word for their kind of sadness, which is both hereditary and eternal. The Patricios of San Miguel Island and the Azores have had their names spelled Petrus, Patrico, and Patrick upon arrival, marriage, and birth. Silva becomes Silver, Cabral becomes Cable, Pereira becomes Perry. 1871. The great Provincetown tidal wave drives the ship Nina into the post office. The captain mails a letter. This story lasts longer than his personal disaster. 1890s, Provincetown registers the highest per capita income in the state of Massachusetts. 1896, the wreck of the Monte Tabor on the ocean side of town. Grounded on the bar on the yards from shore, the Italian captain and mate cannot face the shame of having lost the ship. They slit their throats. The crew is soon rescued. 1903, my great-grandmother Sadie Newcomb, the great-granddaughter of Rebecca and James Birch, and a Yankee, marries a so-called Portuguese at 17. When you have a bun in the oven, she later explains, what are you going to do? Manuel Pat Patrick Bun is born. 1907. Sadie Emanuel Sr. rent a house at the corner of Franklin and Tremont. She gives birth to Uncle John and another one of the children upstairs. Short of cash, they are soon forced to split up the family. Sadie and the children labor in the mills of Rhode Island, something Pat, my grandfather, never forgets. Manuel Sr. stays and fishes off Provincetown. He's a handliner, a dory fisherman, though from what I heard, it seems he's never much good at it. Sometime in the 1910s, Pat's mother is an unbeliever. Therefore, Pat is an unbeliever. The priest slaps the unbelieving child. The unbelieving father shows up and tells the believing priest what he can do with his believing church. The Patricks, once Patricios, come Methodist. 1922, Robert Newcomb, Sadie's father and my great-great-grandfather, says to an advocate reporter, tell him that they're all gone but me and him. His old shipmate has written from Anacortes, Washington. They are the last living examples of their kind, if you count long-line schooner fishermen a species of their own. It is also known that the captain preferred to eat his peas with a knife. 1920s, Pat switches from fish to chickens. Chicken farming never takes in Provincetown. Perhaps it's the sand. 1928, my father is born to Pat and Angie. Pat switches from chickens to innkeeping, though it seems he's never much good at it. 1929, Angie, my grandmother, dies of tuberculosis at the age of 32. Uncle Powerful, her brother-in-law, drives the big black car, the hearse, he thinks, up the hill in St. Peter's Cemetery, since her family was Catholic. He never forgets the funeral, but he told me he really doesn't remember anything else about her. He's sorry. 1933, Pat builds a seafood restaurant with driftwood and lumber from a beach hotel wrecked in a hurricane in Wellfleet. The restaurant is his first and only success. It draws a mixed crowd of locals, writers, and artists, and more of the early gay population that accompanies them. 1936, Sarah Newcomb, my great-great-grandmother, is the oldest person in town. Some days she wanders to the general store and buys candy with Monopoly money. They charge her purchases to her daughter Sadie's account. She walks back to the house where she once lived with her husband Robert and tries to get in. The new owners let her sit by the stove. The pastel cash will not buy her house back. 1937. Rosa, a local woman who has just learned bookkeeping, comes to work for my grandfather in his restaurant. Sometime in the 1940s, Manuel Sr., retired dory fisherman, dying of emphysema, coughs up blood over the sink. My father watches. This is just about all he will remember of his grandfather. 1950s, Anna, just out of high school, becomes a waitress in the restaurant. She wears cat's eye glasses and dances on the tables to show tunes, or so she says. December 25th, sometime in the 1950s, Pat shows up at the door of 8 Mechanic Street with a pair of gloves as a gift for his mother. As I imagine it, his heart is bursting in his chest as Sadie tries to pull the first glove on in the moment before her fingers hit paper. There's a $1,000 bill rolled up in each finger of the gloves. Probably no one among them has ever seen a $1,000 bill, except in a Monopoly game. The restaurant's profits pay the mortgage on the house with the cinder block wall, and Sadie's hands are warm in the new gloves. 1959, my mother leaves Washington, D.C., and comes to Provincetown for a summer to paint. 1950s and 1960s, the town's gay population blooms. A relieved joy comes to live beside the sadness, or the saudade, though no one much calls it that anymore. August 31st, 1964, my grandfather Pat's heart burst in his chest. He dies in his apartment on Commercial Street at the age of 61. He worked himself to death, says my father's cousin Joan. 1974, an unidentified young woman is found murdered in the dunes, with her hands cut off and her head nearly severed. It's rumored that Chief Meade sits sometimes smoking in his car, watching over the unmarked grave of the Lady of the Dunes from the hill below the Pilgrim Monument. He keeps the fractured skull, thinking perhaps somebody's got those hands. 1979, Sadie dies. I meet my great-grandmother for the first time at her wake next door to the Methodist Church. Her bare hands are crossed on her chest. It is all I will remember of her, and I'm not even sure about that. She is buried in the town cemetery, and my grandfather is not alive to be extravagant with her headstone. 1990, cod stocks reach their lowest level in decades. 1991, Provincetown's first experiment with aquaculture fails with the loss of 1 million sea clams. The first real harvest should have come sometime around the end of 1991, and right up to the time when the quahogs were just under their marketable size, about 2 inches across, everything looked good. At first, the newspaper says they think it's perhaps it's the sand. 1990s. Just out of college, I want to be a historian. I sit on the floor in the town library, reading beside a low shelf. Famous artists and writers chatter on down along the shelf, but I want to listen to the silence that is there, too, in between the lines. I imagine I will find something in history that will help me, that learning it will give me something to hold on to when the sadness tugs me down. I soon realize I'll never be much good at it. I am distracted by all the wrong sorts of details. 1994, cod stocks fall to 40% of 1990 levels. 1995, over 200 people die of AIDS in one small town. Our tenant dies, our neighbor dies, my mother's friend's daughter, the one with the beautiful red hair, dies. There's a new section in the town cemetery. The joy and the sadness converge. 1995, I leave town for the city, but I can't stop coming back. 1996, Captain Jay, 2 years older than I am, compares his hands to mine over a table at the old colony tap. He wears a t-shirt printed with a blown-up photograph of his two children. I am the youngest fishing captain on the East Coast, he tells me. I appear to have never done a day's work in my life. The captain's hands are in their mid-50s, dark brown and calloused. 1998, I interview my great-uncle John, powerful, who was just retired at the age of 91, in the house on Court Street that he shares with his daughter, Joan. I confirm some family traits in myself. He is still grumpy at 11 in the morning. There is the work ethic and the obsession with debts. Then there is the sadness lying over everything, the pillows and the caged green birds and the mean little dog. They bring out murky brown photographs of relatives who might as well be strangers to me. I start to think I know how to translate saudade. It is a longing for both the past that maybe never was and for what is clearly passing now. It is the way we miss people when they're still right there in front of us. January 1st, 1999. I wake up vowing never to spend New Year's Eve in the Governor Bradford bar again. None of the townies seem to know how to have fun around here anymore. It smells like mildew and stale beer, and the groups at separate tables glare at each other. That man just got out of jail, whispers my sister-in-law. And those ones at the bar, the nodders. Heroin, she has to explain to me. Skipping ahead. December 31st, 1999. I spend New Year's Eve at the Bradford again. I don't want to lose track of you before the big moment, says Kay, a drunken deckhand with a space between his teeth who knows where the clams still live and wants to show me a magic star outside the bar. He whispers, it's the secret star nobody knows about. It's called Sirius. Late 1990s, Provincetown's per capita income is among the lowest in the state of Massachusetts. Real estate values increase 50% every year. Many of the Portuguese sell their homes and leave, except for the very old. The joy and the sadness diverge again. I don't know how to make it better, except to mail my own sort of letter. March 2000. The body of the Lady of the Dunes is exhumed for DNA testing. It is now the oldest unsolved murder in the state. April 2000. Flyer, the last of the boat builders, the kind of man who doesn't need a book to build a fishing schooner, is spotted wandering aimlessly in the west end of town as if looking for someone to talk to. At 85, his body is frail, but his hand still looks strong enough to tie a knot in the end of a line. Tiz, Rose's husband, who retired from the fishing boats and worked for my family for 30 years selling fishing gear, dies. February 2003, Anna, who worked for my family for 50 years, dies without even a funeral from her only child, a son to whom she gave her cashier's earnings to save a phantom fishing boat that he could not tell her he had already lost. December 2003, my great uncle John, once called powerful, turns 97. He sneaks out of his daughter's house and secretly renews his driver's license. January 2004, Rosa, who kept the books for my grandfather, father, and brother over 67 years, dies. Her funeral is as proper as her life. Her children and grandchildren come from other states, middle class in suits, and thanking my father for giving her a good living here. During the Mass, the row of mourners in the aisle taking communion is small and elderly, and passes my family in our unbeliever's pew like a line of ghosts headed for the sea in the mural behind the priest. Tonight, I look down at my hands. I see that they are pale and anonymous. I look closer and see a long lifeline, for those who believe such things, with a strange split halfway down. An illness, they would say, maybe an accident. I also see the knot of a callus I'm cultivating on the upper knuckle of my right middle finger. I just want to be useful. I just want to be able to remember them. And I think I want to thank someone that I am here at all. I place my hands together. I don't know how to begin. Thank you. Introduce our next reader, Sarah Shaws. The three of us here tonight represent three different eras of Portuguese migration to New England. Sarah is a first-generation Portuguese-American whose family moved here from the beautiful island of São Jorge in the Azores, which happens to be the same island one of my whaling ancestors left in the late 19th century. As Sarah puts it, she now writes to tackle the confusion and the distance that lies between the hyphen separating Portuguese and American. Like some of the best writers of literary memoirs, Sarah has a way of constantly questioning and analyzing her own actions and responses, which makes her the kind of narrator you'd follow anywhere. Since Sarah began writing, she's won 2 undergraduate nominations for outstanding writing and creative nonfiction, published work in the Emerson Review, and she was one of the winners of the Luso-American Scholarship to the Disquiet program last summer. She's an MFA student at Emerson College and an English teacher at Revere High School. Please welcome Sarah Schaaf.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm going to be reading 2 small pieces from my working memoir. Both are about the death of my father, but the first one is my favorite memory of my father when he was alive. It's called Magic. Look at me. What? Look at me, Sarah. Look at me. I'm a Power Ranger who can fly. I lay on my aerial towel in the middle of our backyard, hoping to catch the last bit of heat from the summer sun. Lino ran around me with his Power Rangers towel tied around his neck like a cape. He was still wet from the pool, making tiny brown footprints on the hot concrete, leaving a trail behind him like that of a cartoon map. He vroomed and hissed with his arms outstretched in front of him, going faster and then slower, curving around all Power Ranger enemies he was imagining. He got louder with every swirl he made and sprinkled me with water from his little arms and legs when he got close enough. He was annoying me. "You're not really flying," I said without looking at him. I lay on my back with my arms over my eyes. He stopped running, no more giggling, no more sounds of his tiny feet tapping. "Yes, I am. The real Power Rangers can't fly because they don't have capes. But Papai made one for me so I can fly. See?" I put my arms down to sit up. Lino stretched the towel to the right side of the small frame. He was only 4, but even then he was small for his age. The towel was much longer than he and dragged on the floor. He waved it back and forth as if preparing for takeoff. He lifted his eyebrows and began to smile to say, "See, Sarah, you believe me now." But I didn't believe. I was 8 and in 3rd grade. My friends told me I was too old to watch Power Rangers, even if I only watched it because Lino had it on TV. I was a big kid now. I was the best reader in my class. Lino still couldn't even spell his name. He always drew the L and the N backwards. Even after I corrected him, he still had trouble getting it right and would oftentimes refuse doing it the right way. As Lino ran around me, in my mind, all I saw was a backwards L that needed to be fixed. If I couldn't watch Power Rangers anymore, Lino couldn't pretend to be one. He was wrong. He wasn't flying. He wasn't a real Power Ranger. It was all pretend. "You're stupid, Lino. Papai didn't make you a special cape so you could fly. He probably made you close your eyes and then just tie your towel around your neck. It's not a cape, Lino. It's your stupid towel." Lino stopped flying and stood defeated. Judging from his face, I had guessed right. The arm that held the towel and swung it so proudly was now flat beside him. Tears welled up in his eyes. He wrestled the towel off his neck with anger and threw it on the concrete. He turned away from me and ran into the house crying. I felt like a destroyer. "What happened to Lino?" I looked up and saw my father. He wore his yellow swim trunks and a towel hung around his neck in the shape of an upside-down W. Sweat poured down his face like snakes, slithering their way down his curly-haired chest. I felt worse than before. I would have to tell him what I did. "Papai, why do you have to tell Lino he could fly? That stuff's not real," I said, hoping to cast some of the blame on him so I wouldn't get into as much trouble. Why? You tell him he can't do that? He said. Yeah, because it's not real. Come on, Sarita, don't be like that. But no but. You guys don't know how to play. Me and your Timarin didn't have toys or pools or video games to play with in Saint-Georges. You know what we had to play with? Rocks.